This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Welcome to Joe Plum's political soapbox on Vectis Radio.
Yes, we can.
Because Brexit means Brexit.
This, Mr. President, is a remarkable record.
The Isle of Wight Zoo is having difficulty importing a tiger.
My father gave me a small loan of $1 million.
Which we wouldn't have if we listened to the muttering idiot sitting opposite me.
Joining me on the show today is Nigel Hartley. Hello, welcome to Joe Plum's Political Soapbox. I'm back after a little break over Christmas. I hope you enjoyed our special show last week looking at the people of the year. Loads of interviews with lots of different people, and that will be podcasted, if you missed it, up on my page on the Vectis Radio website. So do have a listen to that, because there's lots of really interesting interviews with a whole range of people from across the island. Who have made it onto our People of the Year list. But today I'm joined by the CEO of the Earl Mountbatten Hospice, Nigel Hartley. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Joe. Good to be here.
Nice to see you. It's an important year this year for the hospice. Can you tell us a little bit about what's
happening? So 35th anniversary. It's a great anniversary to have. I keep thinking what I was doing 35 years ago, and it's a long, long time, isn't it? So it's great that the hospice has been around on the island for that long.
Fantastic. There's a picture that I know is going around the internet of the sunflower umbrellas in the shape of the
35. Yeah, that's right. So we got our staff volunteers into the car park, and Island Roads helped us with a cherry picker and took a great photograph from the air.
That's good. So have you got lots planned to celebrate this
year? Yeah, lots of things planned. So, you know, we're going to sort of roll it out slowly. So January the 27th is the first date for people to get in their diaries. Between 10 and 1 o'clock, we're having a sort of open day where anyone on the island can come along and hear about our plans and hear about the events and the celebrations that we'll be doing later in the year. So we're hoping as many people will pitch up as possible for that.
Fantastic. Sounds great. Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved in working at the hospice?
Well, I've worked in hospices for about 28, 29 years. So it's been my whole career, really. I started off, I trained in psychology initially and started off at a place called London Lighthouse, which is the first HIV and AIDS hospice, where I worked in London for about 8 or 9 years. I went to Oxford, worked at the hospice there for another 8 years, and then went back to London and worked at St. Christopher's Hospice. And I was there for about 12 years prior to coming here almost 2 years ago. So it's sort of in my blood, really, hospices. I think they're extraordinary places, have huge potential, and have huge amounts of support. And you know, as we know, do the most important work with people.
So the work that the hospice does, mm-hmm. can you just explain a little bit about the different areas that they mm-hmm. help and support people?
Yeah, one of our big drives this year for the 35th anniversary is really, I suppose, to bust some myths about what people think about the hospice, because I think people have some very set views and some set sort of understandings, if you like, of what the hospice is and what it does. And yes, we have this building in Newport, which is very important. So we have 16 beds there. Where people come either for the end of their life or either to get some kind of problem sorted out so we can get them back home again, where most people want to be at the end of their life. People, you know, we have the John Cheverton Centre, where we have a huge amount of therapies, group work programme, we have a cafe, things open to the public. But the majority of our work, and this is a really important message to people, is that we look after over 600 people a day at home. And that's really one of the key messages we want to get across to people, that, you know, it costs us just over $7 million a year to run all of this, but most of that money is used in our community, for our community, in their homes.
Well, that's fantastic. Mm. So what are the reasons that people would choose to use the hospice services? Mm-hmm. Say, like, going to use the NHS mm-hmm. services that they provide?
Okay, so the hospice is commissioned by the NHS to provide end-of-life services on the island. So we are the provider of those services. Of course, lots of people will die in hospital and die under the care of the NHS. But when people are living with a life-limiting diagnosis, normally there'll be a point when they will be referred to our services. So our services really happen on many levels. So we have a very expert specialist service, which is really about supporting people right at the end of their life. And that's about making sure people's pain and symptoms are managed so that people can be pain-free in order, I suppose, to be able to communicate with their families, be with the people they love in a good way before they die. So, you know, over 35 years, we've built up the expertise of being able to manage people's pain and manage people's symptoms effectively. So we have that very specialist service, but underpinning all of that, we have a whole range of other services. So people, you know, we always think of dying as being the last few weeks of life. But actually, for many people, dying is over the last few years of life. So we're supporting people during the last years of their life. And that's another myth that people, you know, people think, well, they come to the hospice really when they're right at the end of their life. For a lot of people, we're looking after people during the last years and offering them different things. So people come to the John Chevington Centre, they may access therapy groups, we have a rehabilitation gym so people can keep motivated. You know, we have state-of-the-art equipment there. And we have lots of psychological support, complementary therapies. We have a huge arts program, and a program with schools where schools come in and actually work with people who are in the last years of life to learn more about it. And that's a really important part of our public education. And then we have an army, if you like, of domiciliary carers, so highly trained carers. Who go into people's homes to deliver care packages so that people can remain at home for as long as possible. And then I suppose really that one of the most important things underpinning everything is our 600 volunteers who, you know, again, support our patients and their families, visit people at home, look after people on our ward, and generally, I suppose, offer a huge amount of added extra quality in terms of offering their services to us. I suppose the final thing is, well, the final two things is really we also look after children who are dying in a partnership we have with Kissy Puppy. We're the only adult hospice in the UK to do that. So if there's a child on the island, which is very rare when a child comes to the end of their life or a child dies, we will be able to offer support at the hospice. And then alongside that, we have an island-wide bereavement support service, and that's for anyone who's been bereaved by any death in any place. So it's not just under the care of the hospice. So if you know people who maybe have been bereaved for the death in hospital or a sudden death, traffic, road accident, murder, suicide, all of those things, people can access our bereavement service, both children and adults.
Yeah, fantastic to hear about that whole range of support, because obviously most people would just think about those 16 beds that you have available.
Exactly, and I think, you know, we really need to get that message out there, because it's so much more than a building, and it's more than people think.
Is there some kind of criteria for those people who do need to use the beds and the services that you have?
Yeah, so the people who use our beds and our specialist service that I was talking about just a few minutes ago will be referred to us. So there will be a formal referral via their GP or via a team in the hospital. Some people self-refer. And we would always meet with them, but also always go back to their GP to see where they are in the process of their illness. So there's a very formal process, and people are assessed very carefully. And then what we do is work with them to see which area of our services are best for them at that particular moment.
Brilliant. Do you think that that talking about death is still quite a taboo subject for people? How do you find that communicating those different issues surrounding it?
Yeah, I mean, I think people get fed up with me banging on about this, and this is one of my real interests. We know that part of the problem is that when people come to die, because people haven't had the courage or the support to talk about it earlier in their life and to talk about their wishes, their plans, ask all the questions they might want to ask. We know that people find that incredibly stressful. So when there's the shock of being diagnosed with an illness that means you're going to come to the end of your life, people paralyze, you know, and there's a huge amount of work that you have to do with individuals and families to enable them to talk through all the issues that, that we know are important. So, again, our 35th year, one of our real pushes is to get as many people as possible talking about their wishes for their end of life. You know, so people like yourself, have you thought about what would happen? What you would want to happen, where you'd want to be, who do you want to be with, who, you know, who would you want to be around? Have you got things you want to say to people you love, to your family? You know, just encouraging people to take some time to have those conversations. And I think there are two things. One, we're not asking people to talk about dying all the time. We're just saying, you know, just take a couple of hours, you know, maybe once a year, to sit down with the people you love and actually talk through your wishes and plans. And actually, the other thing is that when people think, oh, you know, if I talk about it, it's going to happen. Just because you talk about it doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. So, you know, we're trying to give people the confidence to do that, so that when something happens to either them or their loved ones, that there's more of a confidence that they're able to deal with it and face it.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic, the kind of sparking those conversations.
And yeah, but it's difficult for people, isn't it? And, yeah. You know, it's a very hard thing to talk about when we probably don't really have a language to talk about it. So, you know, what we want is people to work with us so we can maybe come up with some kind of guide or, you know, points that people can really cover in their conversations. And we know that when people do that, it does make things easier when they need to access services such as ours.
Because I'm sure lots of people will be thinking about the kind of things that they would like to have in those kind of situations, but may struggle to kind of instigate that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's almost sort of, you know, maybe sitting down having dinner or something, you know, having a couple of glasses of wine, and people then sort of, you know, the conversation flows a bit more easily. But it is really important to do, and I know people find it very hard and very difficult, but we can support people to have conversations. And, you know, I mean, it just about planning your funeral, I mean, actually that can be quite interesting to do that. You know, I change my mind every couple of weeks what I want at my funeral, but you know, just that in itself, it's people making a will so that when, you know, when they, if they do die, their loved ones are not left worrying or stressed about money, around, you know, property, all of that thing, all of those things. So it is a really important thing, but we realise how difficult it is.
And kind of linking with this, the work that you do with bereavement and helping and supporting people, what kind of things do you put in place to help those who have recently lost
something? So, you know, most people's responses to the death of a loved one are healthy. You know, bereavement is a healthy process, and we know that there are expected, you know, people will behave and go through things that are expected and things that we know about. So we offer people a short-term package, if you like. So it'll either be a one-to-one support with someone who's trained to listen to them and work with them, maybe in a group. You know, we have memorial services, so we bring people together at the hospice where they can come together in groups to remember people who died. All of those things are really important. We know that with healthy bereavement, people move on if they're supported in the right way. It's when people are not supported that bereavement can become complex, so that if people don't get access to good support quickly or at the time when they need it, we know that that can actually bring up psychological issues for people. It can have effect on people's health. So, you know, we try to be very proactive with people to make sure they know about us and they can access the services how and when they need to. Complex, you know, a lot of people will have lots of challenge when someone dies. You know, maybe if they haven't had conversations prior to the person dying, they haven't been able to say what they wanted, they haven't been able to apologize for something, maybe they haven't been able to tell someone they love them. And people, you know, that dwells on people's minds sometimes for quite a long time. So, you know, the complexity of all of that for people, we try and work with them to offer a service to meet those needs.
Fantastic. So, obviously, we talked about it being the 35th anniversary. Mm-hmm. What are your plans for the future development of the hospice here?
Okay. Well, I suppose one of the real pressures for us is we know that there are more people out there who could benefit from our services who are not getting access to it. So traditionally, you know, people with illnesses such as cancer, with maybe neurological conditions, you know, we're very used to those people coming through our services now. But there are, you know, we know on the island there's a growing older population, people dying from old age, from frailty. Those people traditionally wouldn't get access to our service. You know, people with dementia. So, you know, we have a specialist dementia nurse service now, which is hopefully helping us to meet the needs of those people when they come to the end of their life. So one of the real pressures is how we deliver our services to more people. And inevitably, the costs to do that will rise. You know, our island is incredibly generous. You know, it's a small island, but it's got a really big heart, I think. And, you know, we raise year on year £5.5 million from the island. It's extraordinary to think that. The problem is, as the needs of the island change and more people need our services, we're going to need to deliver those services, and we're going to need the money to do that. There isn't going to be any more money from the NHS. You know, we know the issues that are going on with the NHS. The NHS is an extraordinary organisation, and, you know, we must secure the future of it at all costs. But traditionally, places like hospices have been, you know, the organisations that have delivered end-of-life care. We have to get our act together now and meet the needs of more people. And that's going to be expensive. So there's going to be a real drive to get that message out across the year. I think one of the most important things for us is to not forget to celebrate. You know, it's an extraordinary achievement to be here after 35 years and to, you know, to be... known as a centre of excellence across the UK. You know, there are people, some of our services, there are hospices in the UK looking at us and wanting to replicate them and wanting to take them forward. So, you know, we need to celebrate the fact that we're doing something really good, really innovative on the island in this particular hospice. So we are going to have a number of events. We have a Thanksgiving service at the Minster in Newport on the 4th of May. And there's an open invitation to everyone. We're trying to get people who, over the 35 years, who've used the hospice or who have supported it to come together and really celebrate. We have a fun run at Osborne, so there's going to be a run through the grounds of Osborne in okay. June. That's the first time that's ever happened, apparently, at Osborne. So, yeah. You know, it's again a unique event. And the 13th of October, which is the birthday, it is the day it was opened, we're going to have the hospice big birthday party. And, you know, we're hoping that as many people will come through the doors that day as possible to help us celebrate. And then around that, we've got all of our other fundraising events. So a great Walk the White this year. And we're sort of tagging the 35th thing around that. So, you know, if somebody raises £35, they're going to get a bronze anniversary badge, £350 they get a silver anniversary badge, and £3,500 they get a limited edition gold hospice anniversary badge. So, fantastic. You know, we've got lots of things going on, and we want the island community to really celebrate with us.
That's great. We're going to hear more about that and more about funding and how people can help and support just after this break.
Stay social and get in touch. It's at Vectors Radio on Twitter. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello, you're listening to Joe Plum's Political Soapbox. Joining me in the studio today is Nigel Hartley. We've been talking a lot about the work of the hospice and kind of all of the different things that you have to offer, not just the 16 beds that most people tend to associate with towards the end of life care. But things are changing. You know, a report from the Hospice UK website says that Britain's older population is set to sharply increase in the next few decades. The number of people aged 85 and over is expected to double in the next 20 years. The number of people aged 100 or over is expected to increase more than eightfold by 2035 to 100,000 people. Mm. How do you, what do you think the future of the hospice will look like with this kind of big change and surge of the older population?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, we know our 16 beds are the most expensive part of our services. So for someone to be in one of our beds, that is the most costly and financially costly. So we need to make sure that the right people are in the beds at the right time. And that's a real challenge, of course. I know the Isle of Wight, you talk about, how many years it's going to take before before the older population is extended in that way. But the Isle of Wight is 15 years ahead of the rest of the UK. So in many ways, that future is now for us. And we're going to have to do something quite quickly. I think one of the issues around older people, and the Isle of Wight has one of the highest numbers of single person households in the UK as well. So, it's a place people come to retire to. People want to come and live their dream. It's a beautiful place to live. People can buy a very nice house, and they want to live out the rest of their life, normally a couple. In the best way possible. So, what will tend to happen is one of the couple will die, the person's left on their own, and then they have to fend for themselves. And we need to make sure that all of the services on the island can work together in a more integrated way to be able to support people. We need people to be at home for as long as possible, because we know that's the best place for people to be. So I think our expansion in terms of hospice services will be a lot more around domiciliary care. So we've been over the last year growing a domiciliary care service, training carers to work with us to go into people's homes and do the most simplest of care tasks. So it's washing people, it's making sure people have something to eat, it's making sure that electricity is working, it's making sure people have shopping, people's medication is picked up from the pharmacy. So that group of carers, I think we need to have more of, and that hopefully will help support the island as the older population grows, that we will be able to go into people's homes with really trained skill carers that come with the hospice quality mark. And we are very proud of the quality that we provide. We don't always get it right, but part of really good quality care is when something goes wrong, you take it seriously and you learn from it, and that's what we do, and that we really pay a lot of attention to that. So we're really wanting to do more, but we can only do what we've got money to pay for, and that's the issue.
And that's the frustrating thing for me. It seems like this is such an important service that it's clearly affecting so many people, mm-hmm. a lot more than I first imagined of being helped and supported by this, that only a small fraction of the money comes from government, comes from the NHS.
Yeah.
It's great that people are supporting and fundraising for this, but doesn't that, like, mass of people having to walk the width of the Isle of Wight, show you that this is something that people feel strongly about and it
absolutely.
Should be funded nationally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think funding is an interesting one, isn't it? So the NHS give us around a third of our funding, so it's roughly just over £2 million a year, and we're incredibly grateful for that. We couldn't do what we do without it. But the NHS, probably, if they were providing the service themselves without the hospice being involved, would only use that sum of money.
Yeah.
What we're fundraising for is to bring all of the other stuff around that to make sure that the care we give is absolutely as high quality as possible. There's no more vulnerable time in life than when someone's dying, and I think we have to be able to throw everything we've got at it to make sure that when people die, it can be done well. The people that they leave behind, their families, their loved ones, their friends, can, in a sense, go through it with them and know that the experience the person has had has been the best possible experience, and that then changes their life and their memories of that. Someone once said that, people dying lives on in the memory of those who love them, and that's absolutely true. And if we can create memories that are manageable for people, people then can live with what's happened in a very different way.
Fantastic. And how have in the time that you've been working in hospitals, how's the attitude changed over time? Because obviously we go right back to Marie Curie and the foundation of the modern hospice. At that time, the attitudes were very different to how things have developed now. What have you changes have you seen?
Well, the modern hospice movement is 50 years old this year. So Elman Batten is 35, but the modern hospice movement is 50 years old. And that started with the opening of a hospice in London, St Christopher's, which is where I came from prior to coming here. And that was the inspiration of Cicely Saunders, who originally trained as a nurse. And she worked in the new NHS of the 1940s and 50s. And the problem with dying in the NHS is that dying wasn't part of the vision. it's a national health service. It's about people getting care, getting better, getting on with their lives. So when people die, there was a huge sense of failure in the medical profession particularly. Cicely Saunders used to tell these stories when she worked as a nurse in the 1940s and 50s, where people who were dying were put down the very end of the ward, curtains were drawn around them, and they were left to get on with it. Mm. And, you know, her inspiration was that really shouldn't be how it is. So her attitude and her drive, really, she went out and raised money. So it wasn't paid for by the health system. It was paid for by charity. She raised money to build the first, what we call, modern hospice. And St. Christopher's was built as an inpatient unit initially. And that's why the focus has traditionally been around beds. So it was bringing people from home into the building where they would die, and they would stay there until they die. And since then, life has changed very much, really. So home care, since 1967, when St. Christopher's opened, has become a lot more sophisticated. So, you know, trained nurses, doctors going into people's homes to make sure that they can care for them in the places that they live. So they don't necessarily have to be brought to a separate building. And one of the issues, I think, with hospices is because they were set up where people would come to die in the buildings, they removed death from communities, so they became isolated from people's day-to-day living. And, you know, what we're doing now is putting death back into the community, which is where it really belongs and where it happens most. So things have changed enormously over the last 50 years. There were hospices prior to St. Christopher's, but they weren't purpose-built. They were mostly set around convents and monasteries. They were religious orders where nurses and monks would take in the destitute and the sick and the dying and look after them. So Cicely Saunders' vision was around medicalizing that, if you like, so bringing together a team of expert people in order to enable people to be supported in the right way.
Fantastic. And here on the island, there is such a big support for the work of the Mount Batten Hospice, with so many people taking part in big events that happen across the island, and the amount of money raised each year is a fantastic. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people are so passionate about donating and supporting the hospice here?
Well, I think it's multifaceted, really. I mean, we are incredibly fortunate. Everywhere I go on the island, people know about the hospice, and that's unusual. And it's the geography of the island that make that the case. You know, in London, I worked at the hospice St. Christopher's, sort of about 10 miles around it. A lot of people knew about it, but once she's got beyond that, people didn't. So, you know, it's a very unique setup on the island. Everyone knows about it and everyone has an opinion, and rightly so, in a sense, because the hospice belongs to the island. You know, I feel, I suppose, my motivation in terms of leading it is I want to leave it in a better way than it was when I got here. So, you know, that's my drive to do something about it, and the island are incredibly supportive. So but it's a big ask, particularly when you're talking about money. So going back to your question around what motivates people to raise money, I think one group of people are people who've experienced the care directly. So a lot of people who've had family members die under the care at the hospice, whether in the building in Newport or whether at home, are inspired by that care. To then help us to continue to do that for other people. And that's an extraordinary motivation, I think. you know, to want other people to have the same experience that your loved one has had. So people walk, you know, 27 miles this year, it's on May the 14th, and people do all kinds of other things and amazing things. And, you know, sometimes people raise a lot of money and sometimes people raise not so much money, but that really isn't the issue. There was I came across an older gentleman asked to speak to me. I was at something before Christmas, and he said, I'd like you to have this pound to go towards the hospice. And, you know, everything, it matters. That kind of thing is really important. And for someone who doesn't have much money to want to give a pound is really significant. So the amount that people raise doesn't matter. It's their motivation and their willingness to support something that they know probably deep down, if they're going to live their life out on the island, they're actually going to need it. And whether that's overtly spoken about, you know, going back to the importance of talking about these things, people know deep down inside that at some point it's going to happen to them. And I think that's really, that really motivates people.
Fantastic. What are the different ways that people can support and help fundraise for the hospice?
Yeah, I mean, many different ways. So, you know, we at the moment are putting together a sort of guide pack on how people can put together an event and the kinds of things they need to think about in order to raise money. You know, sometimes people just have a dinner party at home where everyone gives 50 quid or something rather than going out for dinner, and they give the money to the hospice. You know, other people do extraordinary things like trekking around the world or cycling across to France, and there's endless ideas that people come up with, and in many ways that the community come up with the ideas, you know, and then they come to us and say, we'd like to do this on behalf of the hospice, and that's fantastic. Walk the White obviously is one of our major events, and this year, the last couple of years, we've had a Christmas tree lighting ceremony at the hospice itself, and we had that the beginning of December last year. And, you know, about 400 people came along, and people donated money towards a light on the tree in memory of someone they'd known who'd died. And this year, in December, the beginning of December, it's the first Sunday in December 2017, we're going to light up the hospice tree, and we want to do a real special 35th anniversary tree lighting, where as many people as possible on the island can come and be part of that, and hopefully donate some money towards a light on the tree. So there's so many different ways. You know, last year we had a very smart dinner at the Royal Yacht Squadron, and in one evening a group of people there raised almost £70,000. You know, yeah. It's mind-blowing, really. I suppose the real important message around all of that from me and the team at the hospice is that we absolutely assure people that every penny they spend, we will spend as widely, as wisely as possible. And that's really important for people to know that the money they give, we actually take it incredibly seriously. We are not spending money on, you know, having nice furniture in offices and all going off and having lunch out. You know, we're actually spending it where it really, really matters, on the care for people who need it. And that's really important message for people to get.
That's fantastic. How have you found, since taking over a couple of years ago, how have you found the organisation behind the hospice, and what changes have you kind of brought into that side of it?
Yeah, well, we've got a great group of trustees. So we have a trustee board, as any charity would, and in many ways they are the ones that take on responsibility for the well-being, if you like, of the organisation and the charity. So most of those trustees now have been recruited in the last 18 months since I arrived. So we have a new, fresh, very lively and very experienced group of people from all sectors of society, really. So solicitors, you know, fundraisers, people, somebody from the National Health Service, you know, a whole group of people with lots of different experiences. In terms of the senior team, I mean, we know, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, there'd been a very difficult time at the hospice. And, you know, organisations, when they've been around for 35 years, inevitably there are blips and things go wrong. So it's been very important, I think, to get the community back to understand the importance and the significance of the actual work we do at the hospice, not the politics of it, but the fact that we're actually really caring for people at, you know, for people when they're at the most vulnerable time of their life, and we mustn't lose that. You know, you can always criticise or have views on how places are run. You know, we have to manage our money well, because we're entrusted with it by our community. We have to give the best possible care we can give. There are some things you have to do in organisations and decisions you have to make which are sometimes not popular. But my drive is, if I'm always doing it for the best reason and for the best, you know, so the organisation and the hospice remains at the heart of the decision, then I don't have a problem doing it. You know, you have to make decisions well, and sometimes they're not popular, but sometimes they have to be the right decisions for at the right time in order to get the hospice in the right place for the future.
And since moving and starting this place, you've moved over to the island. Mm-hmm. How have you found the Isle of Wight way of life and the differences between your previous?
I absolutely love it, and I think it wasn't that I wasn't expecting to love it, but I've been really surprised by how much you know, we love living on the island. It's the most beautiful place to be. It's incredibly interesting. There are great places to eat, great places to go out. There's lots of art stuff going on. I mean, I'm a musician by background, and you know, there's so much to do. And in many ways, I came from living in London after 15 years. I have more of a social life here than we had in London, because it's just easier somehow. Mm. So we love being on the island. I think it's both an extraordinary geographical area of the country, but also there's a real generosity and welcome and, you know, in the community and in the people here. And I love it, really. So, you know, I was born in North Wales, and there's a similarity, of course, to that. I was brought up in a pub, and I'm now living in an old pub, which has been renovated on the south of the island. So things come round again, but it's a great place to be.
Fantastic. So looking like you're going to be here for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't intend to do anything different. We'll see what comes up. But I said I'd either be here for... Well, I'd certainly be here for 5 years, and possibly here for the rest of my career. Who knows?
Fantastic. That's good to hear. We're going to move on to a bit of the show that we do every week, which is called Prime Minister's Question. It's a quick fire round to find out your personal views, and mm-hmm. we do clarify that it is your personal views of what your thoughts are about different issues that are on the island. It's good to hear for someone who's relatively mm-hmm. new to being over here. So we'll go through these nice and quickly, I think. Are you for or against a fixed link?
A fixed link? Mm. I think there are two sides to that. I think I would be for it, mostly because I think access to services for people would be a lot easier.
Okay. Should we allow fracking on the island?
No.
What's the biggest problem facing the Isle of Wight today?
I think the biggest problem facing the Isle of Wight is how we actually look after the number of people who need care and support.
Are you a saver or a spender?
I'm a saver.
What is the best thing about UK politics?
The best thing about UK politics? I suppose that it changes, hopefully, every few years.
One word to describe Brexit?
Scary.
What's the worst thing about politics in the UK?
The worst thing? I think the slowness of making decisions and taking action.
What newspaper do you read?
The Guardian.
Should we fine parents who take their children out of school for a holiday?
No.
When did you first vote?
When I was 18.
Should the voting age be lowered to 16?
I think that's an interesting question, and possibly yes. I think there are some very mature young people out there who have some very good views on things.
Are you proud of your country?
Yes.
What's the best thing about living on the Isle of Wight?
The best thing about living on the Isle of Wight is how quickly, after a very stressful day, I'm able to relax.
And what's the worst thing about living on the Isle of Wight?
The worst thing about living on the Isle of Wight? I don't think I can say anything about that.
And one word to describe Donald Trump.
One word to describe Donald Trump. Oh, gosh, I don't think I can think of one word. One word to describe Donald Trump. Inexperienced.
Who would win in an arm wrestle between you or Jeremy Corbyn?
I would.
Who will win the next general election?
Labour.
Is Britain full up?
Oh, gosh. No.
Should Scotland become an independent country?
No.
And what would your first policy be if you became Prime Minister?
For everyone to be treated the same.
Fantastic. That's the end of that.
That was quite scary.
Yeah. So, kind of with the vision of the hospice and looking forward and into the future, obviously we've just started a new year, so people are, are kind of thinking of New Year's resolutions and things for the future. What would you like to see? The ways that people are supporting the hospice, the way that the hospice develops and moves in the future for you?
I think, you know, inevitably we need to secure the hospice for the future, and that's going to be through fundraising, and that's going to be through people supporting us, and people digging deep into their pockets to ensure that can happen. I think, though, more than that, for me, there's something about what we were talking about earlier, about really getting the island talking about their own wishes and their own plans around death and their own death, and being able to be easier, feel easier to do that.
That's fantastic. I just want to tell you a little bit about some of the other guests we've got coming up in the next few weeks. We've got three councillors coming up. We've got Councillor Priest, Councillor Whitehouse and Councillor Lumley, who are all coming in over the next few weeks to chat about their views. Obviously, we're going to have a lot more councillors coming up as we have the elections in May this year. We also have PC Finch to talk about schools and his work with the LGBTQ community. And we're also going to have Amnesty International. We're going to talk about their work on the Isle of Wight as well. So lots to stay tuned. And as always, we'll get these interviews podcasted and put up on there. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, Joe. And thanks for having me.
It's good. Can you just remind us about some of the events that we've got coming up in this special year for you?
Yeah, so 27th of January, Friday the 27th of January, between 10 and 1 o'clock, really important. We want as many people to come to the hospice as possible to hear about our plans and to hear about the things we're talking about. And then 4th of May is another important date, Thanksgiving service at the Minster. And then 13th of October is the hospice big birthday party, and everyone on the island has an invitation to that, and we'll be putting out some more information about it.
Okay, that's fantastic. I'm on again tomorrow between 7 o'clock and 10 o'clock with Mitch and Lewis for the Sunday roast. I'll just have a little look at who we've got up next. We've got Chris Sullivan, who's got the Might Not Be 80s show until 4 o'clock today, and then Live Wire between 4 and 5, and Jonathan Bacon, who we had on a few weeks ago, and you can listen to that interview on our page as well. He's there with the All New Hair Bears Record Fair, followed by Darren, and then the Rock Monster Show between 10 and 1. So lots on Vectis Radio at the moment. You can, of course, support us and the work that we're doing to get onto FM if you go on to the Vectis Radio page, vectisradio.com. That'll tell you all about the different ways you can get on the Just Giving page and support and donate. And also, whilst you're there, have a look at the ways that you can support and donate to the hospice. Is there are places on your website where people can donate online as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So go onto our website, right on the front page, top right hand corner, there's a donate button. People can go straight in there and do that.
Excellent. And could we start signing up for Walk the White?
It's going to be launched 27th of January, so at that open day, that's the day, the first day people can get going on that.
Okay, hopefully. How many people do you know you had last year?
Just over 7,500. Oh, I mean, it's the biggest walk in Europe. of its kind.
It's amazing. It's really good. Mm. And how many years has that been running?
It's the 27th year.
27th year.
Yeah, okay. So not right since the beginning, but I think it was after about 7 or 8 years it started.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on. And I look forward to hearing about and seeing all of the different things.
Well, come and see us.
We'll do that. We're great. Yeah. Thank you very much. www.vectisradio.com